Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves, you're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing, or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyrie, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening, friends, and welcome to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. I'm your host, Otis Gyrie. And with me once again tonight is my cohort, Malcolm Blackwood. Together, we've got five tales of unraveling reality, threads pulled loose behind the mind of a master of the form.
Tonight's author, Micah Edwards, is no stranger to the show, or the terrifyingly surreal. In fact, the last three stories you'll hear tonight come from his chilling collection, A Talent for Destruction, a collection of short horror and supernatural stories. Available now from Velox Books.
But before that, we've got something special. The first two tales tonight are brand new, never before heard anywhere else, and making their exclusive debut right here with us.
So if you came looking for something fresh, and maybe something that sees you before you see it, well, you're in the right place.
Now, before we dive in, a quick word from us to you. If you're enjoying these tales of terror, why not unlock even more of them? Ad-free and uncut, early.
That's right. For just $7.99 a month, or less with an annual plan, you can join our patrons area and access our full archive. Hundreds of hours of horror, with more added every week.
To join the darkness, head to SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons, or visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com. It's your best way to support independent horror, and the best way to make sure the monsters keep whispering in your ear. Our first tale tonight is one of those brand new premieres we mentioned earlier. A man mourning the loss of a friend begins to notice strange inconsistencies in his group's shared grief. Photos with the wrong faces, texts that don't come, a silence that spreads like a contagion. This is Don't Worry by Micah Edwards, debuting right here on Scary Stories Told in the Dark and performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. The funeral was more sparsely attended than Barton had expected. He had a vague feeling that he should be offended on Hannah's behalf. She'd always been one of the popular kids in college. Less than 5 years had passed since graduation, and barely any of those people who'd called her a friend had bothered to show up. Now, that wasn't quite true, he supposed. The core group was there, the ones left from the original eight who'd always hung out. Down to four now. Hannah's body was here, lying still and pale in the coffin in the front of the pews, but she wasn't with them in any real sense. She never would be again. Funerals always give Martin a creepy sense of unease. He wasn't sure what you were supposed to be thinking during that time. The eulogies all sounded basically the same. The deceased was thoughtful and kind-hearted, always looking out for others, was taken too soon, and would be sorely missed. There were usually some prayers and then some awkward standing around while everyone tried to figure out the right time to leave. Or maybe not. Perhaps everyone else was lost in deep emotional contemplation, considering how their life would be different going forward. A little voice in the back of Martin's head insisted that this was the case, that everyone else was having an extremely meaningful moment, and that none of them were thinking about the project due next Friday at work. They were all present and achieving closure, and he was not. Dwelling on this didn't help anything, of course. It simply added one more layer to what he was thinking about, instead of listening to the service. Eventually, the service ended. It turned out that Hannah had been both kind-hearted and thoughtful, the sort of woman who was always looking out for others. The heart attack at 26 had taken her far too soon, and she would forever be missed. It was all true, but it just felt hollow. Could have been anyone up there instead of his good friend Hannah. It didn't feel real. Afterward, in the awkward standing around portion, Martin found himself talking to Enos, one of the college crew who'd come out to say his final goodbyes. They hadn't kept close touch since college, but Martin still considered him a good friend. "Rough year, huh?" said Enos. Martin was taken aback a little. Obviously, the current circumstances weren't great, but on the whole, it had been a year like any other, hadn't it? Enos saw his confusion and hurried to follow up. "The deaths, I mean. Seems like the only time I see the gang is at funerals now, and there are less and less of us every time." It struck Barton that Enos was right. The last time he'd seen him had been 5 months earlier at Aiden's funeral, and 3 months before that had been Courtney's, and the month before that was Riley's. This was the fourth one he'd been to this year, yet the frequency hadn't registered. You okay? Asked Enos. He just kind of went white. "Yeah, I just... I don't know. Like you said, it's been a rough year. I guess it all just kind of hit me all at once." "I get it. Stuff takes you in funny ways sometimes." "Definitely," agreed Martin. Privately, though, he was horrified. This wasn't grief playing with his emotions or anything like that. He simply hadn't remembered that he'd been to all those other funerals already this year. Or rather, it was actually slightly worse than that. They just hadn't mattered. He hadn't really forgotten the funerals any more than he forgot his daily drives to and from the office. Like Enos had just said, he'd seen his college crew, or what remained of them, at each one. He could distinctly remember talking to them each time. He could even summon up bits of the conversation they had, if he really thought about it. He recalled the eulogies, the services, the murmured well wishes to the family afterward. It was just that somehow none of it had meant anything to him. Just like his commute, it had somehow been filed away as meaningless. Background. It was an impossible idea. These had been his closest best friends for 4 years, ever since the freshman roommate lottery had put them into two quads across the hall from each other. Jammed in with strangers like that, they were all going to either love or hate each other by the end of the year. Their personalities turned out to mesh well, and even after that, they moved on to other dorms, apartments, and frat houses. They stayed extremely close. Someone once dubbed them the Octopod, and the term stuck. They were inseparable. Only now, Half of them had died, and Martin evidently hadn't cared. Even now, aghast at his own lack of emotional involvement, he only felt surprise at his callousness. They'd been important to him. They were dead. These were facts he knew, just like he knew the times table or the capital of his home state. Like those other facts, they carried no emotional significance whatsoever. "So," said Ennis, jolting Martin out of his private reverie, "funerals aside, how have you been?" Martin grabbed for the lifeline that was small talk. Good. Work's going along. Nothing much to report there. Takes up most of my day, though. You? Yeah, career's going well." Ennis paused. It felt like he was fishing for a specific answer. "You seeing..." There was another odd pause, a slight hitch in the sentence, as if Ennis had pivoted to a different word than he had originally intended. "Anyone?" "Nah, living the single life. I figure the right person will come along soon enough. I'm still young. I'm not worried about it yet." "I think you should, though," said Ennis. "What?" "I think you should be worried." "About what?" "About life. About living. About anything." Ennis's gaze was suddenly intense. Martin took a small step backward, and Ennis grabbed him by the shoulders, not hard, but firmly. "Listen to me, I don't think any of us has as much time as we expected. What's the last thing you cared about, Marty? When's the last time anything mattered to you?" "Stuff matters. I care about my job." Ennis made a disgusted noise. "No one actually cares about their job. Not one in a million. You're not seeing anyone, not planning for anything, not picking up new hobbies. What do you care about, man? There's got to be something." He was physically shaking Martin now. Martin blinked, confused by his friend's vehemence. A thought swam to the surface. "I cared about Hannah. I'm here, aren't I? Came to support the pod." Ennis shook his head and released his grip on Martin. "Look at you, though. I'm literally trying to shake you out of it, and you're not even worried about that. You're too chill. You all are. I mean, what do you want me to say? That it was weird behavior? Everyone's a little off kilter at a funeral? Like you said, it takes you in funny ways sometimes. You're all like this, the whole pod. We're all dropping dead, and not one of you is worried. Not about that, not about anything." "Ennis, never mind. I'll see you at the next funeral." Martin watched him walk away. He wondered if he should do something. After a minute, he decided that Ennis probably just needed to be alone. He was clearly caught up in something inside his own head. There was nothing that Martin could help with. He chatted a bit with Josh and Olivia, the other two remaining members of the pod, catching up on how they were doing. Not much had changed for either of them since the last funeral. They were both in the same sort of life lull as Martin. Low-level jobs, between relationships, living in starter apartments. Neither of them was worried about it like Ennis had been, which just affirmed Martin's belief that there was nothing wrong with it. No one jumped straight into adulthood. That was a transitional period. They'd be fine. There's nothing to worry about. Martin thought no more about it for a while after the funeral. His days were full of the minutiae of life. Work ate the largest chunk of his day, and after he was done shopping, cooking, and cleaning up, there was barely time to relax with a video game before bedtime. The days slid by, formless and indiscernible from each other. This is the nature of life. By the time Martin was looking over the photos he'd taken after the funeral, it had been almost a month. Ennis' strange insistence that there was a problem with their lives was almost fully fallen out of Martin's mind. Something about the intensity of his speech had stuck with Martin, though. He wasn't quite certain why, but he made a point of remembering the look on Ennis' face, the fervor in his voice. It had been a striking counterpoint to the subdued calm of the rest of the funeral goers. It was important, somehow, and until Martin could put his finger on why, he didn't want to let it go. The memory seemed to be fighting him on this. He was having to make a point each day of noting how odd Ennis' behavior had been, how out of line with the surroundings. The memory wriggled like a freshly caught fish, trying to squirm free and disappear back into the depths. It was why Martin was looking over the photos on his phone, in fact. He was beginning to have trouble picturing the determined, almost desperate look on Nina's face. He wanted to see if he'd caught it in a picture, to refresh his memory. He had not. Although he had pictures with Olivia and Josh, both selfies and candids of them with others, there'd been no point in his conversation with Ines where it seemed reasonable to pull out the camera and capture the moment. As he looked at the photos, though, he noticed something else odd. There was another figure in many of them, a person he didn't know. He could not even tell if it was a man or a woman. Their hair was in their face, possibly, or they were blurred from movement. It was a bit of a bizarre thing not to be able to tell what was wrong with the person in the photo, but Martin shrugged it off. He was more curious about who they were and why he didn't remember them from the funeral, in any case. The stranger was not simply in the background of the photos. They routinely had put their arm around the shoulders or their hand on the wrist of members of the pod, showing a deep and comfortable familiarity. They were smiling into the camera for the selfies, just as though they were intended to be in the photograph.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It was a complex smile. Cruel and self-assured. Yet also strangely calming. A fleeting thought crossed Martin's mind. If he couldn't make out the stranger's face, or clothing, or anything about them, how could he see the smile in such detail? He looked over the photos again, but the dichotomous nature refused to resolve itself. It's probably just one of those things, he told himself. A quirk of the camera, or lighting, or something. Nothing worth worrying about. Regardless, the question of who they were remained. Martin picked a selfie showing him, Josh, and the stranger, and sent it to the pod group chat, captioning it with, "Who's this?" Josh wrote back almost immediately, "You and me, doofus." "Yeah, but who's in between us?" "Just some guy. I don't know him." Martin circled the stranger's hand on their shoulders. It was an easy, casual gesture, showing great comfort in being in their personal space. He sent the edited photo to the chat. Looks like they were supposed to be in the photo, like they know us. You really don't remember them either? Dude, it's just some guy. You getting weird on us like Ines did? Before Martin could respond to that, Josh sent a second message. Just asked Olivia, she didn't know him either. You two hanging out? Yeah, she says hi. When are you free again? We all ought to get together some weekend. The conversation rambled on for a bit, discussing vague plans for a beach rental and a weekend getaway. It was not until later that night when Martin was trying to remind himself of the intensity of Ines' behavior at the wedding that two oddities occurred to him. One, it was unusual how little Josh had cared about the man or woman who had inserted themselves literally into the middle of their photograph. For that matter, it was also odd how easily Martin had allowed himself to become distracted from the topic of the stranger. He'd expected Josh to be confused about who the person was, but when Josh had displayed only apathy, Martin had just accepted it and moved on. None of that was normal. Ines would have said it was insane that they hadn't cared. And that was the second oddity. Ines hadn't said anything at all. Not during the conversation, not hours later, not ever. The messages still showed as unread on his end. Maybe everything was fine. Maybe he was busy, or his phone was low on battery, or a thousand other innocuous explanations. Martin knew that Josh and Olivia would not worry about it. Probably they were right. He called Ines, and again. There was no answer. Martin checked his watch. It was just over an hour to Ines' place. Before he could talk himself out of it, he got into his car and drove. On the way, Martin questioned himself about his plan. What would he do if Ines didn't answer the door to his apartment? Could he call the police just because a friend hadn't answered a text? Maybe he could persuade the apartment manager to check. As it turned out, none of that was necessary. When Martin got there, he could see Enos slumped up against the foot of his couch. Martin brushed past the person holding the door open and rushed inside. Enos's body was closed, his eyes were half open, staring listlessly into nothing. His phone lay on the floor nearby. When Martin turned it on, the screen lock was showing a prompt, "Are you sure you want to make an emergency call?" Martin hit OK. When the police dispatcher picked up, he dispassionately reported that his friend was dead. He gave them Enos's address, agreed not to leave, and hung up. He told himself that he was feeling numb, that he wasn't quite right. He could remember having been emotionally numb at traumatic events in the past. There was always a sense of emotions just below the surface, screaming to get out. He felt none of that here. One of his best friends was dead, the fifth one this year, and he was having trouble summoning up the ability to care. Martin looked over the body. There was no signs of a struggle. Enos' face looked drawn and brittle. He'd lost a fair amount of weight since the funeral. When Martin examined the apartment, he found no food in the fridge and no plates in the sink or dishwasher. He wondered if Enos had been eating or drinking at all. Eventually, the police arrived. They escorted Martin out into the hallway while they collected the body. As he passed through the open doorway, Martin suddenly remembered that it had been open as he came in, too. There had been someone holding it, but he hadn't seemed important. Or she. Martin really couldn't picture the person holding the door at all. Could it have been the same person from the photos at the funeral? It seemed possible, though somewhat unimportant. Enos was dead, after all. What did it matter if someone had held the door open? No. Martin pounced on that idea, refusing to let it squirm away. It was hugely relevant if someone else had been in his dead friend's apartment. They could be involved. The police needed to know. Martin flagged down one of the officers. "I saw someone earlier when I first got here. They were holding the door open. That's how I got in to find Enos." The officer looked a bit bored. "Okay, can you describe the person?" Martin floundered. "Yeah, not really. I guess I really didn't get a good look." "The person holding the door for you?" The cop was clearly skeptical. "I could see Enos inside. I was focused on him. I was just saying that someone was here, so can you look into that?" "All right. Well, thank you for bringing it up." The officer had not written anything down. "We'll definitely keep that in mind for the investigation." It was clear that there was not going to be any kind of investigation. They barely had any questions for Martin, who had to admit that from an external viewpoint, his actions and behavior looked suspicious at best. Didn't matter. The police simply marked down that Enos had died of dehydration and thought no more about it. Enos had been right. They needed to care. Something was casting a blanket of apathy over everything, and they had to fight it. Enos had tried to warn Martin, but he hadn't been able to get through, and now he was dead. It was up to Martin to save the others. He'd been unable to get through to them over the group chat. He hadn't even been able to maintain his own focus on the topic. How could he make this work? It came to him in a flash. The eulogy. Everyone from Enos's life would be listening. Surely he could make some of them hear. Even if it was just one person, that would be something. Enos' parents were touched to hear that he wanted to deliver a eulogy. They agreed with no further questions. By the day of the funeral, Martin had carefully honed his speech. He had printed it out and practiced it in front of the mirror. He could feel the importance of it, the passion, burning inside him like a small coal of motivation. He cared about this. He knew he'd be able to share this with others at the service. He could reveal what was happening. His confidence persisted as he climbed the few steps up to the front of the hall, placed his notes on the lectern, and began to speak. He launched into the opening words, the praise Enos deserved, and was pleased to see all eyes attentively on him. He scanned the crowd, making sure that everyone was paying attention, and that was when he saw the stranger. It was not male or female. It was not even human. Its face had no eyes, or too many. Somehow, even looking directly at it, it was impossible to say which was true. All that was certain was that it did not resemble anything human. Its hair swayed gently around it, bobbing slowly through the air, like a corpse drifting at the top of a lake. Its skin hung in tatters and drapes, shifting curtains that concealed its edges in true shape. It's a smile as clear as day, though. Martin's voice faltered as he looked upon that mocking grin, and in turn, it grew wider at his hesitation. It was a smile that said, "You cannot stop this." It said, "You can change nothing." It said, "It does not matter." As the figure stood from its seat, Martin realized that it had in fact said that last one out loud, a whisper that somehow carried over the words of his speech to reach his ears. It stepped into the aisle and began to walk slowly toward him. Its dangling skin rustled and whispered, a soft background to its low recitation. "It does not matter. Everything is fine. This will pass in time. You do not need to worry. Let it go. Let it be. Let go." No one else noticed its progression. With every word, it took another soft step forward until it was standing directly in front of Martin, whispering its soporific beatification directly to him, even as he continued to deliver the eulogy. His eyes skimmed the pages before him, his voice robotically reciting the words. He did not know how to stop. The stranger, still smiling, folded Martin's notes into a small square and slid them into the hidden folds of its body. It slipped around behind until he could no longer see it. He could only hear its calming voice in his ear. "Relax. Nothing needs to be fixed. Nothing is wrong. Things are as they should be. Don't worry. This will all be over soon." The words Martin was saying were no longer the ones he'd written. He had intended to speak about the warning Enos had tried to issue, the exhortation to do, to be, to care. Instead, he heard himself speaking about Enos's kind heart and thoughtful nature. "He was taken too soon," Martin told the crowd. "I'm really going to miss him." They murmured assent as the thing behind him helped him back to his seat. Josh leaned over to him. "That was a nice speech." Martin knew he should warn Josh. He might not have noticed the stranger yet, but his time would come soon. There were only three of them left now. He, Martin, still had a chance to save his last two friends. If he could stir them to action now, then maybe they could still do something. Maybe they could still save themselves. With a heroic effort, he opened his mouth only to feel soft, dry skin cover it as the creature gently wrapped its hand around his face. He could feel the thin flaps of skin from its palm brushing against his lips and tongue. It felt like peace. Martin closed his mouth and relaxed. He didn't even know why Innes had fought so hard, really. There was nothing to worry about, after all.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That was Don't Worry, performed by yours truly. And if that stranger in the photo ever shows up in your feed, I'd suggest you do worry.
And it's just the beginning. As we mentioned earlier, author Micah Edwards has a fantastic collection of terrifying tales out now titled A Talent for Destruction, a collection of short horror and supernatural stories.
Inside, you'll find haunted amusement parks, predatory folklore, and twisted bureaucracy. One tale features a size-shifting house that swallows a friend whole. Another follows a cameraman as he tries to survive the final episode of a cursed ghost hunting series.
Micah Edwards has been crafting horror for years. From the No Sleep subreddit to books that blur the line between sacred and sinister, A Talent for Destruction is available now from Velox Books in paperback for under $20 and in hardcover and Kindle formats at Amazon.com.
It's the kind of collection that lingers. You won't want to miss it. Get your copy today. Our second, brand new, debut follows a woman who thinks she's alone in her apartment until she begins to notice things behind the walls. A thread, a sound, mannequins that weren't hers, stationed like sentries.
She pulls the string, and what unravels isn't just the wallpaper. It's the whole reality she thought was hers. This is Looming by Micah Edwards, performed by me, Malcolm Blackwood. I don't know how long the weaver was at its work before I discovered it. It's possible that I could have changed things if I had found it sooner, if I had paid more attention, if I had done things differently. It's impossible to say, but equally impossible not to dwell on. I'm a tailor. I rent a small shop, a little hole in the wall off a pedestrian mall. I think it used to be a laundry before I moved in. It has a surprising number of rooms jumbled into the small space, doors swinging out of odd parts of the walls to reveal tiny spaces more like closets than rooms. It works well for me. I always need more shelving to store my fabric, thread, and notions. It's amazing how much stuff piles up in a tailor's shop. That was the entire problem, really. There's no way to account for it all, no matter how hard you try. There's always something lost, something rearranged, something missing. You can't defeat the clutter. You have to learn to become one with it, or you'll totally lose your mind. The mannequins were out of place. That was the first thing I noticed. They'd been out of place for quite a while by the time it finally registered. Not the same out of place, mind you. They were moving. Obviously, that's insane. They weren't moving on their own. I only mean that they were in different places day to day, sometimes even hour to hour. Any time I wasn't looking, really. It was subtle a lot of the time, but finally, I marked their foot positions with chalk and proved I was right. They weren't within the marks when I came back. They had moved. I didn't think they were moving on their own. I wasn't crazy. I assumed it was Olivia, my assistant. It was clearly some kind of joke she was playing. I didn't get it, but that was fine. I often didn't get jokes. It would become clear later, or she would explain it to me. Or she wouldn't, maybe. It didn't matter much. The point was, the mannequins were being moved, and I wasn't imagining it. There was a noise, too. It sounded like a loom, the continuous quiet clacking of the shuttle moving to and fro. It certainly wasn't my loom. It was more for show than anything else, and neither I nor Olivia had used it in a year or more. Besides, I could see the edge of it a couple of rooms away. It wasn't the source of the sound. Now that I thought about it, I had been hearing it intermittently for the past few weeks, possibly longer. I'd dismissed it as traffic noise or something from a shop next door, but having recognized the sound, it was unmistakable. I even went over to my loom and threw the shuttle back and forth a couple of times. The sound was identical. Oddly, after I stepped away from my loom, the sound ceased. It was like my shuttle had taken control of the sound by copying it. I went back to my main workroom. All of the mannequins had their heads tilted back, their blank faces staring up at something unseen. Even the headless dummies had a pronounced lean to their bodies, as if they were too trying to look up. I knew it was silly to look up, but I did it anyway. There was nothing there, of course.
Olivia walked in as I was scanning the ceiling. "Something up there?" "Did you move the mannequins?" I asked. "Sure. I move them all the time when I need them for stuff." She looked around. "I didn't turn them so that they were all pointing at the front door, though. Feels like it might make the customers feel judged." I slowly lowered my gaze. The blank heads now faced the door of the shop. Those with arms had at least one raised in that direction, sometimes both. They appeared poised to accuse whoever next entered the shop. Olivia was right. It was definitely off-putting. "Well, help me move them now," I said. I steeled myself as I reached for the first one. I was ready for its plastic body to be warm, to feel its chest rise and fall with breath, to leap away as those rigid hands tried to grip my arms. None of that happened. It moved with more difficulty or awkwardness than usual. Olivia, likewise, was able to shift the dummy nearest her with ease. "Why do you have all these anyway?" she asked, as we moved the last of them back against the wall. There were an even dozen of them, and although most were adorned in half-completed projects, some were wearing clothes that I was not working on, just for the look of things. Two were completely bare. I'd picked them up one at a time over the years. It felt like the sort of collection a tailor's shop should have. They were useful, after all, and they made people feel like work was constantly being done, which it was, of course, but the dummies helped make it more visible. I actually thought I'd had more than this. The others were probably just tucked away in the various nooks and crannies of the shop. They were wherever I needed them, surely. Even if they'd been moving like the others, none of them had gone far. Still, I thought there had been more in the main workroom. Had Olivia moved them? No, she said she hadn't. They had to be where I'd left them. Or possibly I'd just forgotten how many I had. Things did have a way of getting lost in this shop. I always had to be careful with customers' items. It was unprofessional to let them see my confusion when things were missing. I could hear the loom again. I walked over to a wall and pressed my ear against it. It was louder, as if it were just on the other side of the wall, but behind that wall was just another of the small rooms of my shop, and not the one with the loom. I looked inside anyway. Scraps of fabric were piled on the floor. Bolts hung on racks on the walls. The loom was quieter until I pressed my ear against the same wall I'd just been listening to. It again sounded like it was just on the other side, the room I had just come from. I stood in the doorway and pressed my hands against both sides of the wall. They were only a couple of inches apart. There was no possibility that the wall contained a loom. "What are you doing?" asked Olivia from just over my shoulder. She moved as silently as the mannequins. "Do you hear that?" I asked. "Hear what? It sounds like..." I started but trailed off. It didn't sound like anything. The noise had ceased again. I listened to both sides of the wall. I heard nothing. "You seem unsettled," Olivia said. "You sure you shouldn't be sitting?" There was a soft shushing to her S's, a rhythmic pattern to her words. She sounded like the loom. Not wholly, not in any way I could put my finger on. It was just an undercurrent in her voice. "I'm fine," I said. I studied her narrowly. "You doing okay? You seem a little different." "Just my hair," said Olivia, tossing her head to make it swirl. "What do you think?" It looked like yarn, not in a way I could name, just like the susurras in her voice. But it had a quality about it. "It looks nice," I said. She smiled. Her teeth reminded me of the matte plastic of the mannequins' bodies, of the polished wood of the shuttle. I looked away. The door chimed. Olivia went off to greet the customer. As she left, I saw a thick red string trailing behind her. It was attached to her shoe, and it was long enough that I couldn't see the other end. Olivia, I said, intending to tell her. One sec, she said, in her voice like the loom. Let me see to the shop. The string dragged along behind her. It didn't seem to have an end. I wondered if she was unwinding an entire spool somewhere. I picked up the string and began to follow it back, away from Olivia. It led me along for longer than was reasonable, around corners and through doorways and down dimly lit corridors. It seemed wrong even for my warren of a shop, but the pieces around me felt right. Here was a wall of fabric-laden shelves. There was a table covered entirely in needles of various sizes. They were the sorts of things that belonged here, even if they didn't look entirely familiar. The hole in the wall did not belong here. It was huge, tall enough for me to walk through without ducking if I was so inclined. I was not so inclined. The edges were ragged, but not like broken drywall wood and bricks typically are. They were fuzzy, like an unraveling shirt. Long threads led away from the edges of the wall, as if the materials that made it up had been converted to string. They all led to a loom. It wasn't my loom, although it looked like it. This one stood in an empty, well-lit room that resembled a trendy, open-plan, converted attic space. The floors were varnished wood. The walls were bare brick, studded with an unnecessary number of windows. In between the windows were wall hangings of scenes from my shop. Some showed only the rooms themselves, left in disarray as the projects accumulated. A few depicted Olivia or I helping customers. My mannequins featured in several, and Olivia and I each had one devoted just to depicting us. Every one of the banners was stitched in loving detail. I wanted to take a better look, but the closer I got to the threads leading away from the hole in the wall, the more they began to resemble a spider's web. My discomfort surged. I backed away. Olivia was behind me, her second sudden and silent appearance of the day. "You saw my string," she murmured. "You shouldn't just stop." She seized me by the shoulders and began to push me forward into the tattered portal. I screamed and flailed to get free, but her grip was too strong. Inch by inch, I was pushed forward. I could not make her stop. The red string was still in my hands. A gleaming pair of shears was on a nearby table. I snagged it as I was pushed past, and I snapped the blades together on that string with as much force as I could muster. I expected resistance, but the string parted as easily as any other. Behind me, Olivia screamed for a split second. The pressure of her hands vanished from my shoulders. I whipped around, ready to push her out of the way and run, but Olivia was gone. In her place was a mound of clothes, fabric, and sewing supplies roughly the height of a person. A wadded t-shirt was the face. A draped scarf implied the arms. All of it was laced throughout with that thick red thread. But there were no actual stitches or connections. It was falling apart even as I turned, and at my first touch, the pile fell into unrecognizable disarray. There was a slithering noise behind me. I spun back to see the cut end of the red thread disappearing through the portal. I made a grab for it, but it sped to the safety of the other room. As it did so, the loom started up again, pulling the threads from the edges of the hole as it did so. I leapt back, fearful of it expanding around me. But the hole grew no bigger. It was pulling from somewhere deeper inside the walls. I wondered how far those threads extended into my shop. The shuttle raced back and forth across the loom. The figure operating it was blocked by the shuddering threads in the edge of the wall. I could see nothing more than white hands darting occasionally into view. Could it be Olivia in there? The real Olivia? Cautiously, I inched to the side to get a better angle. The thing behind the loom was definitely not Olivia. It was not even human. It was a mishmash of mannequin parts, jammed together into a horrific monstrosity. It had at least 3 arms and more than 7 hands. Some were jointed, 2 at a time, to a wrist. Others protruded from the central mass at random angles, as if struggling to pull themselves free. All of them moved, their fingers wriggling and writhing, clutching at strings and chalk and blades. The heads were worse. I could see 4 of those at first. Like the hands, they followed no discernible pattern for connection. One stuck out from what should have been a knee, affixed upside down with the thigh stabbing upward from its neck and a ring of fingers protruding from the scalp to dig into the shin below. One bobbed at the end of an arm, waving back and forth like the lure of an anglerfish. One was sideways in the middle of everything. A jagged mouth had been carved into its plastic contours, and this chattered open and closed, as if trying to bite the loom in front of it. The final head sat atop the body, such as it was. It turned to me and caught my eyes with its empty stare, and I realized it was not one face, but 2, crushed together with such force that the plastic had buckled and melted. Holes had been gouged out where the eyes should have been, 1 on each face, and a slightly larger shared hole where the 2 met. I could see the inside of the mannequin's skulls through the empty sockets. Its conjoined face split open into an inhumanly broad mouth. It had glittering silver needles for teeth, and it screamed with a sound like tearing metal. Faster than an eye blink, it leapt from behind the loom and scuttled toward me, its hands and feet clattering across the wooden floor. It would have been smart to have shoved a table in front of the hole, or cut the threads coming from it, or anything like that. But it moved too fast for rational thought, and I panicked. I threw the shears at it, and I ran. I fled back through that maze of rooms that now mocked me with their blatant imitations. How had I ever believed I had that many needles lined up? Why had I not seen that the fabric shelves stretched far above where the ceiling could possibly be? How long had this thing been back here, making this lair? How much had I lost? I hurtled through narrow corridors, bumping off walls and tables and praying that I was on the right path. I shoved fluttering drapes aside to find the path ahead lined with mannequins. I skidded to a halt, momentarily certain that I had circled around to find myself returning to the monster. But these all stood individually, not hurled together in a malign clump. They were mine, the remaining ones from my shop. Those with arms were pointing to a door up ahead. They were not blocking my path, but guiding it. Still, my heart pounded as I pushed past their plastic bodies. Was this a trap? I had no choice but to follow. I could hear the scraping pursuit from behind me, the terror racing even closer. I dove through the door ahead, hoping against hope that it was the way out. The mannequins had steered me true. I found myself in the front room of my shop, surrounded by mundane clutter instead of the piled mockeries from which I had just run. The door to the outside was just across the room, and I sprinted those final few steps. But as I touched the knob, it fell apart in my hand, collapsing into a loose pile of string. I heard a rasping laugh from behind me, metal on metal. I did not turn to look, but my gaze flickered to a mirror mounted on the front wall. The horror stood there, stopped in the doorway by an unyielding line of mannequins. It struggled to shove them aside, but could not budge their steadfast shield. Before I could even wonder how long the barricade would hold, the monster reached down and seized a long brown string that was running across the floor. It yanked, and the string in my hand that had been a doorknob burned across my palm. I yelped and lost my grip. The creature snarled as it whipped the string toward itself, folding it into an intricate cat's cradle across 4 of its hands. To my shock, it pulled away not just the knob, but the entire door, and where there should have been an exit to the street was only a blank plaster wall. It looked as though there had never been a door there at all. I looked around the room in a panic. The floor was covered in strings leading to the desk, lights, windows, and ceiling. They were everywhere, connected to everything. I was standing on them. I moved to stand on more solid ground to prevent the horrid weaver from pulling the boards out from under my feet. To my abject shock, one of the strings moved with me. I was not simply standing on it. I was connected to it. The monster and I dove for that string at the same time. I, unconstrained by the mannequins, seized it a split second before its many hands could grab hold. We engaged in a brief, desperate tug of war. I could not let it have the string. I held on as if my life depended on it. I knew it very well might. I wrapped the string around my hands. I could feel it cutting into my skin. And then, at a final tug from the monster, it snapped. I felt a brief electric pain through my entire body at once. I screamed as I stumbled backward. Would I tumble into scraps, as Olivia had? I collided with the wall behind me, still very much flesh and blood. My relief was short-lived, however. Although my mannequins prevented the monster from passing the doorway, they could not stop its greedy, grabbing hands from seizing string after string. Windows vanished, dimming the room. The lights fell, darkening it entirely. I could hear the rush and rustle of whispering strings all around me as my shop was torn apart into nothingness, gathered up in scans in the arms of that devouring thing. The empty dark was all around me. Even the whispers faded away into nothing. I sat in absence forever. Time itself had been unraveled. And then a touch, a gentle nudge. A plastic hand touched my wrist, guiding it forward. I felt wood, a frame, suspended strings, my loom. I groped blindly around until my hands touched the shuttle. I did not know what was on the warp. I did not know what I would be making. But I knew I had not found this by accident. I had been brought to this for a reason. I moved the shuttle timidly at first, afraid to lose it. I kept my hand on it and on the strings, ensuring they were still there. I could not lose them again. I could not be alone in the darkness anymore. The reassuring hands of the mannequins were still with me. They anchored me in place, reaching past to hold the loom, to guide the shuttle. I began to throw it with more confidence. The mannequins pressed their bodies against mine, huddling tight, protecting me from the dark. Eventually, a dim light came back, enough for me to begin to see my work. The strings stretched into my loom from all around, coming from the nothingness, pulling from nowhere. The mannequin's hands worked in concert with my own, smoothing the emerging fabric, throwing the shuttle, weaving the cloth. I could not tell where they ended and I began. We moved as one. The weaver had tried to steal everything from me. It had almost succeeded. But I was strong. I was capable. I would take it all back. With many hands I wove, building the tormented corners and cubbies of my shop back as they should have been, stealing back what the monster had tried to rip away. I smiled. And the mannequin smiled, listening to the quiet sound of the loom. That was looming, and let this be a lesson. If the walls are listening, don't talk back.
Especially if they answer in thread. Our third tale, and the next two that follow, are all taken from Micah Edwards' book, A Talent for Destruction. In this one, a moment of poor judgment during a solar eclipse opens a permanent window into something utterly alien. This is Eclipse Blindness by Micah Edwards, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Everyone knows you're not supposed to look at the sun. But we've all done it from time to time, right? Not like stared at it or anything, but just glanced up at the wrong time and gotten an eyeful. It's not a big deal. You squint, you blink away the after images, you move on with your life. And on cloudy days, you can kind of look for a while, and it doesn't even cause a problem. So a couple of years back, there was a big solar eclipse. I wasn't in the path of totality, but I still went out to look like everyone did. The thing is, I hadn't planned ahead enough to get those special eclipse glasses. I read a little bit the day before about making a pinhole camera to safely look at the eclipse, but it sounded like that was just going to be a stupid picture on paper. And if I wanted to not really see it, I could probably just look online. I figured I'd just bring my regular sunglasses, then wait until it started getting dark and then look. That was going to be the cool bit anyway, and most of the sun was covered up. Yeah, it was bound to be basically safe to look at it. Obviously, everything online was full of dire warnings about how looking at the eclipse could make you go blind, but there's always someone online shouting about how something or other can kill you or maim you. It's like when you look at a tag on a piece of furniture, and it always says that, like the stuffing or something, is known to the state of California to cause cancer. California seems to know that about an awful lot of things. Now, I'm not saying they're wrong, but the constant drumbeat of it just kind of dulls the warning, you know? Anyway, so I looked at the eclipse, and it was pretty cool. It was hard to make out at first, what with how bright the sun is, but when I squinted a bit, I could see that there was a big bite out of it that was slowly getting larger. Also, when I looked away, I could see where it was shining through a tree, and all of the little dots of light in between the leaf shadows were making crescent moon shapes, or crescent sun shapes, I suppose. Crescents, at any rate. And I guess that's what the pinhole camera would have shown. So actually, it would have been neat after all. Fine. Lesson learned. I probably looked at the sun a little too long, because I had some gnarly after images for a while there. There were those black-blue spots, like you get after a bright camera flash, only they stuck around for a half hour or so. I was honestly beginning to get a little worried that I really had done something stupid before they started to fade. I was looking up eclipse blindness online and freaking myself out when I noticed that the spots were gone from my right eye and my left eye cleared up soon after that. Mostly cleared up, anyway. I was still getting this odd sort of blurriness in one bit, like you see in old photographs where someone moved it just before it was done developing. Just a real faint overlay of something else over the actual picture. I figured it was just another after effect that would fade in a little bit, and I didn't worry about it too much until I went to bed that night. When I closed my eyes, though, I got a bit spooked. That was when I realized I could still see those overlay images through my left eye, even though it was closed. It wasn't all of my eye, actually, just a fat crescent, same as the shape of the sun shining through those leaves. But in that crescent, in my vision, I could see things that didn't match up with the world around me, even with my eyes shut. In fact, I could see them better without anything else behind them to hide their shapes. Through that torn bit of vision in my left eye, I could see a room that didn't match the one I was in. My bedroom was maybe 8 by 10 feet, carpeted with light gray walls that I'd never gotten around to hanging any art up on. The ghostly room I could see was much bigger, the size of a hotel lobby. I couldn't make out any colors, but there was a lot of glass and shiny metal. It looked fancy, wherever it was. When I turned my head, my view of the other room shifted just as if it was actually there. Even looking from side to side without moving, my head changed my view exactly as it should. I spun around trying to take it all in, and that's when I noticed there were people there, too. My eyes popped open in surprise, which made the images harder to see, but did not make them go away. I could see wisps of movement as the people passed through my field of vision. Cautiously, I closed my eyes again. No one seemed aware of me. I was as much a ghost to them as they were to me. More so because at least I could register their presence. They had no idea I was there at all. I saw one figure heading for a distant exit and decided to follow him. I wondered what would happen if I left the building. Would there be a world outside, or would this weird vision reveal itself to be just a hallucination? If it was there, I figured, well, I could find a street sign or something to tell me what I was seeing, and that might help clarify if it was real. I made it about 3 steps before I walked face first into my own wall. It was a genuine shock when I hit it. I'd been focusing on the ghost world so intently that I had legitimately forgotten that my eyes were closed and I was in a different space. For a moment, I was tempted to go outside and try to find someone to follow in a larger space. Then I had an image of myself wandering blindly across neighbors' yards and into the street and decided perhaps I should go to bed instead. There was a good chance that this would be gone in the morning, and if not, I could deal with it better after a full night's sleep. I laid in my bed and closed my eyes, which left me staring at the ghostly metal ceiling far above me until I fell asleep. In the morning, the visions were still there. There seemed to be more people than before. It made sense if it was morning there, too. I did my best to ignore them as I got ready for my day, but my bathroom was still in the middle of that same large room, and it was very distracting to have people walking through me as I showered. I tried to keep my left eye open as much as possible, but that just led to me getting soap in it. Eventually, I gave up and accepted that I was going to have to shower with immaterial beings from now on. Later that day, I walked out to the center of a big field and closed my eyes. On the walk out there, I was able to tell that I was somewhere busy by the speed at which wisps had been zipping through my vision. But I hadn't expected to find myself in the middle of a street with a car bearing silently down on me. I yelled and threw myself to the ground out of sheer instinct, but the only thing that happened was I got grass in my mouth. The car went through me like everything else from that world, as it did the others behind it. I wasn't there to them. Once I calmed down, I closed my eyes again and made my way to the street corner. Although I was in the middle of what looked like a major city, there were no traffic lights or crosswalks. The corner only had a tall, oblong pyramid rotating slowly in place. The pedestrians waited and stepped into the intersection based on no logic that I could see. The cars never hit them, though, so clearly the system worked. The pyramids, as I came to call them, were my first clear indication that this was a completely different world. Like I said, it's been a couple of years since the eclipse. I've had a lot of time to look around this place now. They ran a lot of things off of various forms of the pyramids. Everything from lights to farming to traffic control. They're some sort of form of neural interface. I have an idea that everyone in this world I can see is psychic, or at least psychically linked. People seem to know where everyone else is and will be. I've never seen a traffic accident. I've never seen 2 people run into each other. I don't know if this is because of the pyramids or if they built those as an extension of this ability or what. Everyone and everything is linked, though. I've been hoping for years to figure a way to break into this connection, to get them to notice me. I'd love to be able to talk to them, to exchange information. I haven't told anyone else about my eclipse vision because I know how crazy it sounds. But if I could bring back real information from another world, they'd have to believe me. I've tried all sorts of things to be seen or heard or felt, but nothing works. I'm just not there for them. Until last week, I was out at the grocery store and a man at the end of the aisle caught my eye. Couldn't figure out why at first. He just looked like anyone else. I looked around to see if there was anything or anyone else near him that I'd spotted instead, and that's when I realized that I could only see him with the damaged crescent of my left eye. He didn't look like the Ghost World, though. He looked just like anyone else, in full color and opacity. I stared at him, trying to figure out how this could be, and he turned back and stared back. I fell back a step, shocked to be observed. He raised an eyebrow and quirked a smile at my reaction. He said something, some short sentence or word, but I couldn't hear him any more than anything else from that world. He tipped an imaginary hat at me and walked out of my field of vision. I haven't seen him since. What I have seen in the other world is panic. People are running, fleeing, carrying children in backpacks and armloads of possessions. Cars are streaming out of the city, their trunks jammed full and roped down to hold them shut. Still, everyone moves in that effortless ballet with no accidents, not even any real traffic jams. They cooperate as well as they always, but whereas before they were always doing so in peace and joy, now the overwhelming feeling is terror. The people are gone now. The city's abandoned. Worse than that, the city itself has begun disappearing. Building by building, street by street, it's going away. In most of my usual locations, I can't see anything of the other world through my left eye anymore. It's just dark when I close my eyes now, like it is for everyone else. For other people, they're just seeing the inside of their eyelids. For me, I know I'm staring off into a dead, empty blackness that used to be a world. I don't know who the man I saw was. I don't know how he did what he did. But I do know that he saw me. He saw me, and he said something. Every night, I stare into the hole that used to be a world, and I wonder when that man will come for our world as well. That was Eclipse Blindness, performed by yours truly. Makes you wonder, what if sunlight is the filter keeping the truth at bay?
And what if that crescent in your vision never fades? What if it's watching back? If you enjoyed tonight's journey through haunted hallways, cursed homes, and whispering walls, you're in luck. There's more waiting for you in the patrons area. Extended ad-free episodes featuring bonus tales and exclusive horrors you won't hear anywhere else.
It's just $7.99 a month, or save big with the yearly plan, and it gives you full access to every story, every scream, without a single commercial break. You'll be supporting indie horror and making sure the doors to the dark stay open.
To join, just head to simplyscarypodcast.com and click the Patrons tab, or go straight to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to become a member. Come closer to the stories, if you dare.
From all of us here at Chilling Entertainment, thank you for your support.
If tonight's episode proved anything, it's that the missing things are the most dangerous. A friend's vanishing concern. A thread tugged too far. A son that showed too much. A painting erased and replaced. A home that forgets the owners but remembers you.
Some absences aren't accidental. Some holes were made on purpose, to trap, to lure, to build something else. These stories from Micah Edwards remind us that horror doesn't always come crashing in. Sometimes it waits patiently. It hides until you start asking questions.
If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to our parent channel, Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, on YouTube. Hit that notification bell so you don't miss the next visitor lurking just beyond the veil.
And if you want even more eerie tales, tune into my other show, Otis Gyre's Tales from Duskwood. That's where I take you even deeper into the strange and the sinister. You'll find it on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you do your listening or your hiding.
We want to hear from you, too. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and let us know which story gnawed at you the most, or which one you're afraid to replay in the dark.
And finally, a big thanks to Micah Edwards, tonight's featured author. From debut stories to selections from his book, A Talent for Destruction, he's shown us that what you can't see still sees you.
So next time you find an old photo with a face you don't recognize, or a thread sticking out from the wall, or a door that wasn't there yesterday,
remember, it's not what's missing that's the problem. It's what's waiting to be found.
Sleep well, listeners.
If you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.